Feeling stuck by a tough life decision? Wondering how to navigate career and leadership changes without chaos? Welcome to Problem Solved, the podcast where we cut through the confusion and turn uncertainty into action. I'm your host, Cheryl Strauss Einhorn, and I'm here to empower you with a powerful tool, the AREA Method. Forget overwhelm, forget endless Googling, get ready to make confident, well-researched decisions that take charge of your life. Whether it's finding the perfect college, the ideal career path, or the best care for your loved ones. This isn't just about theory. Here we'll tackle real-world scenarios, dive into inspiring stories, and equip you with actionable steps. So buckle up, listeners, because it's time to say goodbye to indecision and hello to solutions. Emily Gregory is co-author of Crucial Conversations and a Crucial Learning Master Trainer who's helped thousands of organizations such as Intel, Yahoo, and the Mayo Clinic achieve a new level of success. Emily holds a medical doctorate degree from the University of Utah and a Master of Business Administration from the Marriott School of Business at Brigham Young University. She's a dynamic speaker who has spent her career identifying and leveraging behaviors crucial to effective living and teaching. Emily, I'm so thrilled to have you here today. We always start off with the same question. So would you share, why is problem solving important?
Oh, Cheryl, what a great question. And problem solving is so important because I think about our progression through life as just actually overcoming a series of problems. That's what helps us stretch and grow and develop and become more. So it really is the path to becoming that person that we want to be. And I think where I really focus on that is in terms of problem solving within relationships, right? For me, my life's passion and my work is all about how do we enter into relationship with others and how do we build relationship with others in the service of getting great results, of creating happiness and joy in the world, whatever it is. But it's so much about relationship with people. And when I think about problem solving in the context of relationship, I mean, I think every relationship I've ever had, at some point, there's been a problem. There's been a friction. There's been a rub. There's been that moment where you and I think differently, and we have to figure out how to collaboratively solve those problems if we're going to enable ourselves to have that relationship, to have that closeness, to have that connection, and do those great things together.
Well, that's a beautiful answer, and your passion for the topic absolutely comes through in your book. So decision-making in relationships can feel overwhelming. Would you go over for us, what are some of the key principles that help people make better decisions under pressure?
Right. Well, again, as you mentioned, the book that that I've spent so much time with, it's Crucial Conversations. And just as maybe kind of a foundational for those folks who aren't familiar with the book, Crucial Conversations really talks about conversations, right? Interpersonal with one another, moments of friction where we have to talk things out that involve three things. So one, high stakes, it's got to matter, right? The decision that we're about to make has to really matter. Then opposing opinions or differing perspectives. That's the second element of a crucial conversation where we see this decision or this problem a little bit differently, and we're going to have to navigate that. And third, and this is the challenge, and I think what really makes it problematic and overwhelming is strong emotions. Almost inevitably, right, when something really matters to me, it's high stakes, and you see it differently than I do, we have those opposing opinions, almost inevitably, I'm going to get emotional about that. I'm going to feel that. It's going to feel overwhelming and stressful and urgent and frustrating and whatever that emotion is, but it's going to come in strongly. And that really, that's really what creates, I think, a lot of the mischief and the challenges that happen in crucial conversations. And so one of the things we really work on it around a principle is how do I have that emotional regulation that allows me to bring my best self to this conversation, to help you bring your best self to the conversation so that we can make that decision, whether it's under pressure or not, that we can make that decision well.
I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about how to attain that elusive emotional regulation and share sort of what's the biggest mistake that people make when approaching a crucial conversation.
Yeah, perfect. So it is elusive. You are right. It does feel elusive. Even for me, I am still working on it. And every once in a while, I feel that flooding of my body with adrenaline and emotion. And I'm just, oh, you know, and I have to take a moment to create some space for myself. But here's what I have found is so valuable that Crucial Conversations teaches us about what to do when you take that pause, when you take that beat, when you create that space. And it's a self-reflective skill that we call mastering our stories. Because if you look at like where these emotions come from and what really drives and reinforces and pushes our emotions, it is almost always the stories we've told ourselves about that other person, about the situation, right? I look at you and say, you don't care about what I care about. You're not invested in this in the way I am. You know, whatever judgment it is I make about you, that starts to drive that strong emotion in me. And so what I need to do is step back and say, oh, actually, that emotion, it's not coming from what you've done. It's coming from the story I told myself about what you've done. And that gives me that space between stimulus and response, that space where I can challenge the judgment I've come to and really interrogate it and take responsibility for it. Now, it may not be that my judgment is wrong, right? Maybe you really don't care about this issue as much as I do, right? Maybe whatever negative story I've told about you really is accurate. But the process, that cognitive process of engaging with our story, challenging it, acknowledging it, naming it, that lets us take so much more responsibility for it, and it lessens the emotional tone. I can still have the story, I can still have the judgment, but now I'm engaging with it cognitively rather than emotionally. And so that is what I would say is the big key to how we think about regulating those emotions, is really understanding you got to own the story that you're telling yourself, because that story is the fuel. It is the fuel that is firing those emotions. Now, go ahead.
I'm just going to point out that you're basically saying that thoughts are not facts.
Right. Yes, that's a beautiful way to express it, right? And I think it's important to sort of to separate the thoughts that we're having, our perception of reality, from reality, and being able to say, okay, my perception is still valid. I always worry when people start to separate that, because then it feels like we're doing it so that we can dismiss our thoughts, our perceptions, our judgments. And I don't want us to do that. I think oftentimes our judgments are incredibly valid and very important parts that we bring to the conversation. But what I think is so important in that thoughts and facts separation, right? The facts and what I thought about the fact, being able to separate that, is again, that's a cognitive thinking skill where we start engaging that neocortex and our brain starts driving it rather than our emotions driving it.
I do think that's so important, but the metacognition that's involved in that, especially when our emotions are high, I think that's a very hard thing to access, even if you're somebody who's practiced self-awareness, truly cares about relationships. So I just wonder, how do you think about the emotions influencing that ability to identify, take hold, and then step away from the story?
Yeah. What has been helpful for me is to reframe the emotion as a cue. So I have taught myself to say, oh, when I'm feeling frustrated, that's a cue that I'm telling myself a story. And that's the door that I need to enter. If I can just get that connection, strong emotion, anger, frustration, defensiveness, fear, upset, whatever that emotion is, okay, that's a cue. And I start to see my emotion as a piece of information that tells me something. And the cue is, Emily, you're telling yourself a story. What's that story? How can I think about this differently? Why would a reasonable, rational, decent person do what they're doing, right? All the questions I can ask myself. But the door that opens it, that creates that space for it, is to reframe my emotion is a cue. It's a piece of information that tells me something. Now, maybe it just tells me how important this is to me, right? And that's okay too, but it is that piece of information that tells me you're telling yourself a story right now. What's that story? And that's the door through which we enter.
So labeling the emotion becomes really important. Let me just ask you then, if that is sort of the key for being able to recalibrate for a crucial conversation, would you just differentiate for our listeners what's different about sort of everyday decision-making advice for someone on a day-to-day basis versus in these very high-stake crucial conversation moments?
Yes. So I think there's a couple of things. One we've talked about, right? The strong emotions. And probably the reason I focus there is I think most of us, when we're not in the throes of strong emotion, we actually show up really well, right? Like 90% of our day, we can be respectful and candid and doing the things and making good decisions and involving others. It's when those emotions get so strong, right? So that's definitely the number one thing that differentiates crucial conversations, decision-making from everyday moment. But the other thing that I would suggest we think about is who needs to be involved in the decision. So a lot of my day-to-day decisions, they're my decisions to make, right? And I'm doing things and I'm making choices about how to use my time and where to put my energy and effort and what to dismiss or leave aside, right? I'm just making those decisions for myself. But crucial conversations are fundamentally, as I said earlier, about relationship. We don't have crucial conversations with ourselves. I mean, sometimes we have hard life conversations with ourselves, but by definition, a crucial conversation involves another person. And so then you have to say, well, is this, how are we making this decision? Because suddenly it's not an individual decision, it's a collaborative decision. And that's really different. We specifically talk about, and I think it's so helpful to think about in those decisions, are whether out of this crucial conversation, we're going to make a consensus decision or a consult decision. And those two are just a little bit different and well worth clarifying with the other person so that we both have an understanding of how this decision is going to be made together.
That is so interesting. We think a lot about decision ownership, and I think that that is what you're talking about, collaborative versus consensus, is sort of who's owning that decision at the end of the day, singular or plural. So let's stay on workplace settings for a minute. Obviously, there's so many power dynamics in the workplace that can make crucial conversations even more difficult. How do you recommend approaching a tough conversation when there's a hierarchy, a boss or somebody in a position of authority versus, let's say, a colleague at your level or somebody who you are a leader or manager of?
Yeah. So I think that the you have to acknowledge that the whatever conversation you're having with whatever person at whatever level, every crucial conversation, in order to be successful, has to create psychological safety for me and for the other person. We talk about making it safe so that meaning can flow in, right? And we have to create that safety. Now, where the power dynamic gets interesting in that is power can kind of create a little bit of psychological safety without even doing anything. If I'm in charge, I probably feel a little bit more safe psychologically than the person who's not in charge. It doesn't mean that I always feel safe, right? I'm a human being just like everyone else. And we need to be thinking about creating psychological safety for our leaders and our managers just as much as for our direct reports or as our peers. But there is that power dynamic that feels like I hold kind of a power card because I can always, you know, trump this down and be like, I'm in charge and this is what we're doing. So the question, I think, really is less about how do you have the conversations at different levels and more, how do you create psychological safety regardless of the level you're at? And one of the, I would say, just most profound and impactful pieces of, I think one of the most profound and impactful things that we've learned, that I've learned from our research over the last 30 years, is about what creates safety in a conversation. And this is what we have learned. People do not become defensive because of what you're saying, the content of your message, the thing you're talking about. People become defensive because of why they think you're saying it, your intent, and their perception of your intent. So if you want to create safety for someone, the very best way to do that is to start just by sharing your good intent and saying, here's why I want to have this conversation and why it's important to me. And that works whether you're talking to your manager or your peer or someone below you, right, in the organization. It just works across the board to start with your intent. Now, one note on that, and that I think is a little tricky about what our good intent is. We usually start, when you say, why are you having this conversation? We almost inevitably start from a place of why it's important to or for me, right? That's why we have the energy to have the conversation. But if I come to you to share my good intent and it's all about why this is good for me, that's not going to create very much safety for you. So I have to stop and say, what is it I really want? Not just for me, but what do I want for you out of this conversation? Not what do I want from you, because that's not going to create safety, but what do I want for you? And that's the intent I want to start with, and that good intent to share.
That's really, that's a great way to think about frame of reference when you come in, when I'm thinking for you, because then it's much more, I want to more deeply understand your perspective on the matter, the facts that you have, and so on. And you're not trying to influence the outcome of that conversation. So yes. I really appreciate that. How about though, when everybody wants a say in a decision, how would you think about that situation? Because that's so tricky, and it's hard really to create psychological safety when it's not going to be possible for everybody to really have that say.
Yes, yes. So a couple of frameworks that I think are helpful for, and one I mentioned earlier, is differentiating between a consult and a consensus decision. So what we would talk about. So for example, right, I come to my team and I think, oh, I want to get their input on this because then I'm going to make a decision. And I go around to everyone on the team and I ask them what they think and they give me input. And then I think, oh, that's some good input. And I got some other input from some other people and I read this best practice research and I'm going to take all that together and this is my decision. And I put that decision out there. And some members of my team look at it and say, what is she doing? Like, that's not what I told, like, that's not what we talked about. That's something totally different. And that doesn't make any sense to me. And they're really frustrated. And the source of that frustration is there was a mismatch in expectations around the decision-making. So I was coming to it and saying, I think this is a consult decision and I'm going to consult here and here and here and here. And then I'm going to make the decision. But because I didn't articulate that, they experienced it as a consensus decision. Oh, wow, Emily, she's such a great leader and she's coming to ask my opinion and I get a say in this and I get to be part of this decision and it's so wonderful. And then when the decision sort of looked different than our conversation, they saw that as a real miss and a loss, right? So one of the most important things you can do is say upfront, this is a consult decision. This is a consensus decision, right? And which of the ways we're going to go? One nuance to that that I often find effective, especially in teams discussions, is to say, I want this to be a consensus decision for us, right? I want to get to consensus. And we're going to have to make a decision in the next hour. That's how long we have to make this decision or whatever the time frame. So if we can get to a consensus decision in the next hour, that's great. And if we can't, it will revert to a consult decision. I'll take everything you've said and I will make the final decision, right? So it's just really about clarifying that that framework or that decision-making up front. The other one that I like, and there's all sorts of different decision-making frameworks about how you involve people and RACI and things like that. But I have always liked one that was just very simple about who has the D, right? Who has the decision, the D, the R, and the I. Some people get to give input, some people get to make recommendations, and some people get to make the decision. So that's a nice model as well that can help. I think fundamentally, though, what I have found, again, in the context of relationships and building strong relationships, it matters less how you're making the decision and more about we set it up front. We were explicit about how we were making this decision so that there's not a miss in expectations there.
Really appreciate that because that clarity then sets the constraints around the conversation and the expectation that the other people are going to take away. So I think you've addressed this a little bit, but I think it's such an area of misunderstanding, which is sort of hidden assumptions or unspoken concerns. So if you could address how to handle that and how that can lead to better decision outcomes.
Yes, I love that. And actually, like you said, it does just tie there, because the challenge is when we have assumptions about, for example, how decisions going to be made, and then we don't clarify, that just leads to frustration down the road. So I think one of the most powerful things, and let's just maybe keep with this example of my team needs to make a decision, and if I shared how to make the decision and everything. Let's say, for example, I say, hey, this is how we're going to make the decision. And you disagree with how we're making the decision. But what's great about the fact that I shared it out loud is that then that becomes a conversation we can hold. We can actually have a conversation, not about the decision, but about how we're making decisions. And those conversations, those I would call them process conversations, are so critical to both making good decisions, but also building strong relationships. Because if all we're ever talking about is the decision or the project or the deadline, but we never get to, again, that kind of meta conversation about how we're working together, how we're making decisions, how we're soliciting input, how we're responding to feedback, then we really miss the ability to build those strong bonds of relationships. So I think that's the first key, is sometimes we teach a skill called CPR. It has nothing to do with cardiopulmonary resuscitation, but CPR stands for content, pattern, and relationship. And it's three different conversations, and it helps you sort of pull apart and say, I just need to have a content conversation. I don't like this decision we made. I don't think this is the right decision, et cetera, right? We're talking about the issue. We need to have a pattern or a process decision about how are we making decisions and how are we soliciting feedback and things. And sometimes we might need to have a relationship decision, which is, hey, based on this pattern of how decisions are getting made on this team and problems are getting solved, I have some real concerns around trust or competence or how we're relating to one another, because these patterns are not working for me. This process is not working for me. And so being able to separate that out and say, is this a content issue, a pattern issue, a relationship issue, can be really powerful. And not surprising, most of the problems in our relationships and our teams and our organizations come from a failure to have conversations at the pattern or relationship level. We're really good at the content level. We'll talk about problems all day long, but we don't start talking about process, pattern, and relationship and how we're working together.
I think the other thing that makes this so useful is the lexicon, because it also separates ourselves from what's actually going on. And so having that gives us something to wrestle with that depersonalizes it and allows it to go under the microscope, I think probably in a way that's much more comfortable for people as well. So I really appreciate that. So are there other barriers to clear thinking or to our organizational structures that you think would lead to better decision-making?
I think when you said other barriers, I think one of the barriers that I most often see about having a crucial conversation. So if we presuppose that having a conversation, getting more meaning shared, is going to lead to better decision-making, hopefully better decision-making and more commitment to the decision, right? Then we say, okay, well, what's that barrier to that crucial conversation? And one that we haven't talked about that I see so commonly is what we call the fool's choice. And it's just this very binary thinking we have of, I can either be kind or I can be honest. I can be respectful or I can be candid. And people will say, right, I'll say, why didn't you speak up about that? Why didn't you say something about that? Well, I need to, you know, that's my boss. I have to show respect, or I didn't want to hurt that person's feelings, right? I wanted to be kind. And we have all of these justifications for quite often why we often don't speak up very well. And it's usually because we're making this like false trade-off. And so I think one of the biggest barriers is that trade-off. And the solution to it is to shift our mindset and to realize that the kindest, most respectful thing we can do is to be honest and to be candid. And if we can reframe that for ourselves and realize, as Brené Brown often says, clear is kind, right? If I can be candid with you, that is the most powerful example of me showing care for you, is to be honest with you. Then I think we start to unlock the ability to have those conversations, be honest and forthright about it, get the clear, honest, accurate information we need in order to make those good decisions.
It sounds so simple, but so difficult in practice, just like the metacognition.
Well, and actually, sorry to interrupt, but I actually, when you say it sounds so difficult in practice, that word practice is key. I think oftentimes we miss that. People will read Crucial Conversations and say, oh, I really enjoyed your book. It was so great. But Crucial Conversations isn't something you understand. It's something you do, right? I say to people, it's not a cognitive science. It's a performance art. And just like anything else, it requires some practice. And too often, I don't think we actually do practice it. We try to have a conversation and we count that as practice. But if we were really serious about practicing these skills, we would find ways to do a small part of it, get some feedback on it, right? Practice, in my mind, is not practice unless you're getting some feedback and some reflection and thinking about how you can do it better. So I think that starting to think of crucial conversations and communication is not something that I'm innately good at or bad at, but a skill that can be learned if it is practiced is part of what we have to start getting to if we're going to ever move forward.
I agree with you. And I think that's also, again, why the lexicon is important and why understanding the crucial conversation actually has a definition, as you pointed out at the beginning. So let's shift gears just a little bit. How do you help people, you know, prioritize effectively when everything seems important? So you need actually CPNR. What does that look like? And how do you figure out, is there a suggested entry, Emily, or what would you recommend to people?
Yeah. So I think that's a great question of, like, first of all, recognizing that we have trade-off choices, right? And starting to see the decisions we make to have a conversation, to go here, to do this, it's simply a trade-off choice. I actually try and take it out of a value judgment of a right choice and a wrong choice. I think it's trade-offs. And I think what you have to start recognizing is, what is that trade-off and what's the consequence of my trade-off? So for example, with crucial conversations, as I mentioned, the most common trade-off choice we make, especially when it's high stakes and it is urgent and it seems really important, is to actually say nothing, right? We tend to go most often to silence and say, it's too high stakes. It's too, like, this is too big. Like, I can't have this conversation, or we don't have time to have this conversation. And we choose to go to silence. But what we don't realize is, what are the trade-off choices of going to silence? And so a lot of our work has been around trying to identify those trade-offs. What's the cost to the organization? We did a study several years ago, and we asked people to try and just put a dollar figure on a conversation they were avoiding. And the average dollar figure, this was a group of about 1,000 people that we surveyed, it averaged out at $7,500 per conversation, right? The cost of being silenced. When I go and I avoid and I do workarounds and I don't say this and we don't solve the problem. So I think that part of it is, in those high stakes situations when there's urgency and pressure, is to not let yourself think, oh, silence is the easier way. This is the fastest way forward. I'll just agree and it will be okay, right? Because there's such a consequence to silence. As kind of a tangent, just because it's the two of us women here talking, and I know that at least some of your audience are women, I'll tell you just an interesting tangent, I think, about one of the most impactful studies I ever read about the cost of going to silence. So this is about 20 years ago, and it was some research that came out of the Framingham Heart Study. So this long-term study done by the National Institutes of Health, and they go into Framingham, Massachusetts, and they've been monitoring and surveying and talking to these people for decades now, right? And in fact, most of what we know today and we just accept as truth around heart health, like diabetes being hard or smoking being hard or high blood pressure being hard for your heart, like, that actually came from Framingham. Okay, so this is about 20 years ago, some researchers were interested in going into Framingham and looking at what was the impact of different conflict resolution strategies within married couples. And so they were specifically looking at a specific type of conversation, which is, we disagree and we probably have to make a decision, and, like, we're in disagreement about it, and what are our strategies for resolving that and coming to decision, and how does that impact us? And one of the strategies that these researchers identified was what they called self-silencing. So it's that conversation where, like, I just choose to say, you know what, it's not worth it. I'm just going to go to silence, right? It's a high stakes. I'm just going to go silent. I'm going to silence myself. And they found that on average, about a third of men regularly self-silence as their primary means of conflict resolution. And about a quarter of women do regularly self-silence as a primary means. A conflict resolution. Okay, so then the question is, well, what impact, if any, does it have on heart health? And so they looked at the men, right, who self-silence and those who don't. And when they controlled for all the other variables, they found not much. Actually, there's kind of no impact, right? So I tell my husband that all the time. I'm like, you just keep self-silencing yourself. No, not really, of course. Sometimes I want to, but no, I don't. But no impact there. But here is the kicker. For the women, when they looked at the quarter of the women who regularly self-silence compared to the three quarters who don't, and they looked 10 years out, those women who regularly self-silence were four times as likely to have a serious adverse cardiac event, which is code for heart attack or stroke or death. Four times, right? So for women, that experience of self-silencing, and I think this is true whether it's at home or in the workplace, it's incredibly stressful for us. And it releases all sorts of stress hormones that have a very deleterious impact on our heart. And so as we think about, like, what are those costs of silence, I think we should think about death, right? Like our hearts, our heart health, in a very real, very meaningful way as we think about those costs.
Fascinating. So let's turn to the rise of artificial intelligence for a moment. It's increasingly being used in conversation, whether it's chatbots or workplace tools or conflict mediation. And I think more and more people might be using it to prepare for conversations. So do you think that AI can assist in crucial conversations? And how does or will human judgment remain at the center of
conversations? Yes, such a great question. And actually, as we think about AI, I want to go back to what we were just talking about a few minutes ago around practice. I think one of the things I said about crucial conversations, if you think of it as a skill that I want to develop, then I need to practice, right? And if I'm going to go practice hitting a tennis ball, I'm hopefully going to have a coach there that says, hey, your grip's wrong and do this and adjust your swing like this. But oftentimes when we think about crucial conversations, we don't have anybody to tell us how we're thinking about that. AI, I have found, has some great insights for us there, right? I can say, hey, ChatGPT, I need to have this conversation with my boss. And here's what it's about. And this is what I'm thinking of saying. And can you give me some feedback? Like, is this good? Is this bad? Can you give me some feedback on that? So it's a great tool to give us that coach that can give us some insights of, oh, nice job, Em, but I'd probably moderate your approach here or think about this as well. So I have found just so much help from AI, both in crafting messages. Like specifically, you can give a prompt that says, like, I'd like to have more psychological safety in this message I'm about to send. How could I increase the level of safety and the likelihood that someone would respond well? I think it's great for those kinds of things. Now, the question of, is it ever going to replace human interaction? I don't believe so, right? I think what we're trying to say is, how can we use it to help us develop skills we need to come to that human interaction, right? I don't want my chatbot to be interacting with your chatbot and me just sitting off on the side, but I do want to be able to learn and use that to say, I need to go have a tough conversation. How can I hold that conversation better?
Perfect. I think that that could give people a lot of comfort and ease to get to sort of try it out and be able to see how it can help prepare for something that is going to have especially an emotional tenor or might not be received well. So in that same vein, what kind of advice do you have for leaders making tough calls when there's no perfect solution?
Well, first of all, I think to step back and realize that decisions don't have to be perfect to be effective, right? Sometimes I think we look for that elusive, oh, I need to have this perfect decision. There is no perfect decision, but your decisions can still be really effective. And that is, I think, the marker that we should be looking for, right? Taking action and refining as you go often actually does lead to better outcomes than waiting for the perfect answer. And so I think rather than saying, I need to make a decision that is perfect and is going to be final, we should be looking at it as, how can I fail fast? How can I analyze and adjust? And to do that, of course, we need to be committed to putting the mechanisms in place to analyze and adjust, right? We make a decision, but do we, in addition to that decision, do we think about what's the process for feedback on this decision? Yeah. When am I going to come back to this decision? And how many months of data do I need to assess to know whether my decision was right or not? Those are the kinds of questions that I encourage leaders to think about at the time of decision making. Great, this is your decision. How will you know if it's right? How will you know if it's wrong? When will you look at it? What data do you need to collect? How will you collect that data? So that it's almost... it's just almost assumed that any decision that's made is going to be adjusted as we go along. And that's part of the decision-making process.
Absolutely. So the success metrics and being able that there's a way to collect them and share them together. So could you recommend for us just a small habit or practice that listeners could start using today to improve their decision-making?
I'll give you two for that. So one, I think, and I know I've heard you talk about this as well, which is to whatever it is you do to externalize your thinking, right? So we've talked a lot actually about that metacognition. And sometimes the easiest way to make that happen is to write it down, is to get it outside of your mind, right? So it could be mapping pros and cons or mind mapping or talking to a colleague or throwing it into an AI tool and saying, here's what I'm thinking about doing. You know, what do you think about this decision? But it, not because I need the chatbot's answer, but because the process of me externalizing it is going to help me crystallize and clarify my thinking. So that's the first one. Whatever you do, externalize your thinking. And then the second one for me is just to ask, what's the very worst that could happen, right? We tend to overestimate risks and underestimate our ability to adapt. Right. And that's where we're talking about perfect solutions. We want them because we're so worried that if they're not a perfect decision, we won't be able to adapt to it. But human beings are incredibly creative and infinitely adaptable, I think. And so if we can just say, like, what's the worst thing that could happen here and verbalize that, that can give us a lot of freedom to move forward, I think.
Heck. And what's, you know, when you think about your own large body of work, what's sort of the most surprising thing that you've learned about decision making and that you sort of take away from the work that you do every day?
I would say, well, some of them we've talked about actually, right? So I really do. It's been so helpful for me to realize decisions don't have to be perfect to be effective and to externalize our thinking and all of that. But here's one more that I would say, and it goes back to what we were talking about how decisions get made. I think that changes over time in the context of a relationship. And I think we need to allow for that. So, If you'll permit me, this is a personal example, but I think it illustrates the point that would work at work as well. So several years ago, my six-year-old daughter and I were driving in the car. She was way in the back seat, all buckled in tight, and we were headed off to an event. And we'd been rushing out of the house, and I hadn't really paid attention. But as I looked in the rearview mirror and I looked back at her, I looked at her face and I thought, oh, I think she's got mascara on. I think she's wearing makeup. She's six. What is this? You know? And I said to her, I said, do you have mascara on? And no kidding, this little six-year-old, sassy, fantastic woman to be, said to me, it's my body. It's my choice. What do I have on my hands here, right? But what was so interesting is it created that conversation I talked about earlier around how we're going to make decisions. And I was able to talk to her and say, hey, you're right. It is your body. And you have some choices about that. But let's talk about choices. And of course, this is who gets to make decisions about that. And we talked about when you're 2 months old, you don't make any decisions. And when you're 21 years old, you make a lot of decisions for yourself. And when you're six, you're somewhere in between, right? Mom gets to make some decisions. You get to make some decisions. And then we had a conversation that we have continued to have. It's become a touchstone for us as she has grown, is to come back and say, okay, now here's where we are. Do we need to change our mix and our balance of how we're having those decisions? And I think that's really important and has been something I've learned, because as I think about relationships I've had with mentees, right? People that I'm mentoring or coaching or developing, or employees that work for me, when they come in fresh out of college and they don't know anything, I'm not actually going to let them make too many decisions on their own that are going to impact our business. But as they go forward and they grow, they should get more decision-making capability. And so I guess in summary, I would say that one of the surprising insights has been how infrequently we revisit our decision-making and how we don't let it flex as people grow and develop. And we need to be more flexible about that.
I think that's a really beautiful message to leave people with, because we have many decision-making archetypes inside us, even though we have a dominant way to be in the world. So I really appreciate that. And what a lovely story about the relationship with you and your daughter. Would you share for us, how can our audience find you, find your work, and stay in touch with you?
Yeah, so absolutely. The best place to go is cruciallearning.com. That is our book and training company where we bring both Crucial Conversations, but all of our other courses as well, some of which have some impact on decision making, and would love to come back and talk about those at some point if possible. But cruciallearning.com is the best way. You can also find me, Emily Gregory, on LinkedIn, and I would love to connect with any of you who are listening and have found something valuable or just have a follow-up question to ask.
Emily, I thoroughly enjoyed your book, but it doesn't do your enthusiasm justice. So thank you so much for being here today. And to all of our listeners, thank you for joining for this episode of the Problem Solve podcast.
Thank you for having me.